first of all, Roger, you just come back from retreat. I know you like to take an annual pretty significant retreat, don't you?
I try to. I've usually gone a couple of months in each year for the better part of 30 years. So, yes, it's been part of my life. And I just got back from doing a retreat with Lama Suryadas, which was very valuable. So I'm back in the world.
Fabulous. Was that out in New York?
No, Lama Suryadas has centers. His main center is in Texas, and I was there. He's doing a four-year program, which is basically providing the basic sadhanas of the traditional three-year Tibetan retreat. So it's a layperson's way of getting having an opportunity to do some of those very amazing practices that the Tibetans have created.
That's fabulous. I know Ken has spoken about Mahamudra and Dzogchen as two of the most profound traditions, and I guess with the most access to the non-dual, the best understanding of it from a long time back, and maybe the practices that facilitate those sorts of state transitions the most easily.
Well, there's certainly an amazing profundity there. You know, as Ken once said, the Tibetans for 1,000 years didn't create much in the way of art or science or architecture or basically anything, but they sure did investigate the inner universe, and they came up with a very profound inner technology and a philosophy and psychology to match, which is, and each culture has their own particular emphasis and contribution. I think that's certainly one of the Tibetans.
Yeah, I used to joke and say that technologically, the Tibetans just barely got up to yak butter. But for 2,000 years, they sat in caves and looked at their minds. And it's probably the longest sustained, most impressive phenomenological investigation anywhere on the planet. And when you see that there are at least two types of religion, there's sort of exoteric, dogmatic, mythic story, narrative religion, and then there's esoteric, transformation of consciousness, great liberation religion, then the Tibetans have arguably contributed more to that than any other tradition. Now, this is, going to be said by one of the questions that you have is, Roger and I are also what you might call polymaths in terms of traditions that we've studied. I mean, I've, as much as I've practiced Buddhism, don't really consider myself a Buddhist, because I have much too affinity with Vedanta and Christian contemplative and Kabbalah and so on. But my gosh, starting with the whole Tibetan pantheon of practices is probably the most complete, if you had to pick one, probably most complete, and goes in depth into the non-dual, certainly as much as anything I've seen.
Yes, I certainly, like you, I have an enormous appreciation for all the great traditions and the contemplative disciplines, and have been a professional dilettante. My wife calls me spiritually promiscuous, exploring as many of these as I can. Of course, we're in this extraordinary position of being the first people in history able to do that. I mean, a few hundred years ago, not only weren't they geographically accessible, but if you even hinted at an interest in other traditions, you might likely end up on a funeral pyre.
Yeah.
So we are unique in not only having access, at least in our modern Western world, and not only having access to these traditions, but having the political freedom and religious freedom to be able to investigate them. So this is extraordinary, and I think there are a growing number of us who have made use of this remarkable opportunity and tried exploring various traditions. And I think, as you were hinting at, Ken, each tradition has extremely valuable contributions. Each has its own particular emphasis. Each has its own set of techniques and technological expertise. Each also aims for predominantly, as we'd have to get into this in a little more detail, for specific levels and stages and so forth and states.
Right.
So one can actually map out traditions along kind of your Wilbur Combs lattice in terms of where the traditions focus or have their center of gravity.
Right.
Knowing, of course, there's a wide spectrum within any tradition. And having said, I think one of the interesting opportunities we now have to look to have is to begin to map out and compare traditions along something like Wilbur Combs Lattice, and also to do a comparison on the different techniques and technologies that that each tradition brings to us.
Yeah, and we have an enormous number of ways to map what they're doing as well, without being reductionistic. So one of the things, for example, that's useful with the four quadrants, as simple as it is seeing that the upper left and the upper right are not the same. They can't be reduced to each other, but neither can you get rid of one without the other, that they literally, all four quadrants, arise together. And so what we're looking at when we talk particularly about the states or transformations of consciousness that these great paths of liberation bring about are changes primarily in the upper left quadrant. What's happening in America, of course, is that these are being subjected to scientific investigation. In other words, examination of what happens in the upper right quadrant, what happens in brain states. And there's a great deal of positive merit to that. I think one thing we have to be very careful about, though, and that is that in the type of research that's being done, Mind and Life comes to mind doing really fine research on this. But the downside is you get into these states of consciousness whose primary goal, incidentally, is to show you ultimate spirit. I mean, meditation is not the royal road to the unconscious. It's the royal road to God. And so that's what this discovery is. And what happens is the people find that, oh, you do this kind of meditation and the G-spot in the brain lights up, or there's increased gamma waves. And then everybody says, ah, well, meditation is really doing something. And they reduce it to scientific materialism, the exact opposite of what should be happening in terms of validating what meditation does in its own domain. And so we have to be careful about that. But there are indeed ways in the upper left and other matrices to look at some of the differences between these traditions. And Roger's right, they're not all the same. And you can indeed map them out. And that's one of the things that we've tried to do is look at the combination of all of the different traditions, sort of put them all on a table, and then figure out what they're similar, what the differences are, if they can all fit together in some sort of composite map, that kind of thing.
Yes, indeed. And you know, there's a lot in what you said, so just picking up on a couple of themes. One of the things which happens, of course, these days is now we have access to different traditions, the attempts at comparisons, and sometimes the issues which come up about comparative evaluation and so forth. And one thing that needs to be kept in mind is that there are different tastes, and as you can point out in one of your books, you know, just because you can find the common ingredients in cooking, it doesn't mean you want to mix
yeah.
French and Chinese.
Exactly.
And there really are matters of taste, and different practices and different traditions appeal to different people. And of course, for the vast majority of people, inculcated from birth onwards into a particular tradition, and don't think of, or at least haven't in historical times, think of moving outside that. And of course, it's quite a challenge to do so. It's a threat to one's worldview. It's a threat to one's understanding. A ego death in some ways to even begin to look outside one's worldview, constituted so deeply and broadly as it is by its religious constituents. So there are also the idea, which you've pointed to before, that we can map and try to make sense of and understand, look for common elements of all these traditions. And there are also going to be elements of conditioning and personal taste in what people are drawn to.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if you can say that there are, if we look at a half dozen traditions that aim for the abyss or the void or emptiness or nirvikalpa samadhi, and then we look at another half dozen traditions that punch through to something like non-duality or sahaj or bhava, even though there might be a dozen that go for one state and a dozen that go for another state. What Roger's saying is really true, that for some people it's just a matter of taste. It's just some of these traditions feel right. Some of them are ones that you simply try, and if they speak to you deeply, then it's probably going to be your path. And if they don't, then there's no reason trying to push it. You can find virtually comparable depth paths in many, 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 many different traditions around the world. And so one of the things that we're looking at is what happens now in today's postmodern world, now that we know that. In other words, what could be some of the religions of the future? What would they look like? And I'm sure we'll get into this down the road, but the idea would be, for example, that, let's say, Christian centering prayer, and I mention this because this is Father Thomas is already doing some of this, would be one of the ways that if your taste, you simply felt comfortable with a Christian lineage, nonetheless, some of the practices that you do in the Christian lineage are influenced by some of the practices and tastes that have come from Zen or Dzogchen and some of the Eastern traditions. And Father Thomas is, of course, himself a connoisseur of world's traditions, and that's had an influence on what he's teaching. So what we're really looking at is what would be the form of religion of tomorrow? And among many other things, one is it's going to have to distinguish between pre-rational and trans-rational. It's a disaster that the liberal press, not the conservatives are any better, but that the standard liberal press thinks that what somebody like Genpo Roshi is doing and what somebody like Pat Robertson is doing is the same. It's fundamentally the same, just because they're religion. They have no comprehension of the fact that those are at almost opposite extremes of the spectrum of development. And it's so bad that I keep thinking the religion of the future is going to have no religious terms in it at all, that we really revert more to just transpersonal terms, suprapersonal, superconscious, transrational, and have absolutely nothing in terms of terminology that could mistake it for pre-rational, mythic, dogmatic belief.
That's very interesting. So one direction things could move in our postmodern world, and of course there are going to be many different currents then, is essentially a secularization of terms or an updating of terms so they lose a lot of the historical baggage and association.
Right. Right.
And maybe framed in contemporary psychological, philosophical, etc. terms. That,
right.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
And then the different tastes that we were saying that you brought up, which is always true, somebody might just have a taste for Vedanta, some might have a taste for Sufism, some might have a taste for Kabbalah, some might have a taste for Christian mysticism. But in the trans-rational, sort of post-modern world, the idea would be that the influence from these different traditions means that within each of those lineages, you would have at least major practices that cover most of the bases. And that's just sort of a pet theory of mine. In other words, in Sufism, for example, where there is not as much, let's say, tantric visualization, then the incorporation of tantric material from the East would be incorporated into Sufism. And so if you were drawn to Sufism, you still would have a wide variety of menus within those disciplines that would come from the mix and match, in a positive sense, of what's now actually already happening in the world's traditions. Roger, you and I probably don't know a single major spiritual teacher where we can say that person is the product of just Zen or just Vedanta or just Kashmir Shaivism. Virtually all of them, even people that are Zen teachers or have practiced other things, have done, if nothing else, Krishnamurti and done certain amounts of mindfulness. It's just almost impossible to separate. But product, we are.
That's very interesting. Yes, I hadn't thought of that. I suspect it says a little about the limited company we keep, because of course there are many traditionalists. But you're right.
Well, exactly. Well, and that's exactly what I'm not talking about. Of
course, right. Exactly. Yeah.
Pat Robertsons, the Oral Robertson, et cetera, Osama bin Ladens are not going to be known.
Well, even people who are doing transformative practices as opposed to the mythic believers,
right.
You know, there's still a tension within traditions between those who are experimental and open versus those who are the true traditionalists, trying to keep things the way it was and
true.
Or stick to it. So, but I think it's a very interesting point you're making, that certainly as I think of the people who have been most inspiring to me, and the people who are doing innovative, creative work and can really making cutting contributions, all of them, I guess, almost by definition, are pretty open-minded. And as part of that open-mindedness, our modern world is you are exposed to any number of different cultural and traditional streams.
Right.
So yeah, I think that's a good point.
And they all have had their influence on those of us who have been working with basically a international type of transformative practice, if you will. Remember Lex Hickson? What was he was formally transmitted in, what was it, 4 different traditions? I mean, literally transmitted in 4 different traditions. It was that kind of classic 1960s, 1970s, classic boomer, I think the good side of the boomers in this case, which was just a hunger for all things Eastern, really meaning contemplative, because we didn't know that the West had a contemplative tradition. We were brought up in Sunday school and in the Bible Belt and in, oh, God knows, the mythic membership, amber, conformist traditional value structure, Sunday school, and the New Testament was about it.
And we were kind of exposed to a mythic level of religion and went looking for something else, found the best in the Eastern traditions, and then compared the transpersonal dimensions of the Eastern traditions with the West. The West didn't look so good. Then, of course, there was certainly for me, and I think a growing number of us, the recognition, oh my, there are those levels and depths within the Western traditions too, but they just haven't been at the, they've been more suppressed
right.
than in the Eastern ones.
Right.
But it was
and
slow recognition.
It was slow recognition. And then a lot of people came back to the West by traveling first to the East and then ending up comfortable with Western traditions, at least the esoteric contemplative portions of them. Of course, it's, as you well know, we tend to, a lot of people in the West, particularly America and Europe, tend to think of Japan and India and even Tibet, as being nothing but sort of, you know, full of enlightened Zen masters.
Uh-huh.
Most of the religion over there is not nothing near like that. It's the religion, there's a fundamentalist traditional religion that is just rife in those countries as well. It's the same developmental process that gets from archaic to magic to mythic, and most of the majority of people practicing religion in Eastern countries have essentially the same fundamentalist structure in terms of their belief. They believe they're supposed to do certain things. If they behave correctly, Buddha's going to smile on them, they're going to die, they're going to go to Tetsuga heaven. I mean, it's almost indistinguishable from fundamentalism over here. But all that said, there's clearly in the East, and India being sort of the mothership, there's a fountain of state training, state transformation, and religion as a transformation of consciousness that is just truly astonishing and of much deeper and wider grasp than we find generally in the West. Although, again, in the West, there's plenty of it when you know where to look. But, boy, we certainly didn't get that growing up. And as soon as at the end of World War II, when D.T. Suzuki's essays in Zen Buddhism were translated into English. The historian Lynn White said that the translation of Suzuki's essays in Zen Buddhism into English would rank with the translation of the Bible out of Latin. And that turned out to be a little too strong, but it was indicative of the extraordinary explosion of interest that it caused in a basically a Western world starved for contemplative understanding and seeing an abundance of it in the East. And that has just changed things that we're all still working in the wake of to this day.
Yes, I think clearly much of our cultural turmoil can be traced over the last few decades, at least a part of it, to the transition the West is going through from being what anthropologists call a monophasic culture, one which is predominantly, almost exclusively centered in the ordinary waking state, to
right.
a so-called polyphasic culture, which at least recognizes and begins to draw on multiple states.
Exactly.
And down the line, hopefully there'll be an appreciation of difference between multi-stage and mono-stage cultures. That is, again, cultures which center their have their center of gravity in the recognition and draw from one stage predominantly, as opposed to those which explicitly recognize the possibility of drawing from and philosophizing and psychologizing from multiple stages.
Yeah, I think going from monophasic, basically gross waking state, sensory motor orientation, and the best you get out of that is the occasional sort of nature flow mysticism, which most people have experiences of, but that's even somewhat suspect, to put it mildly, and the state that is taken as the official, real state of consciousness in the Western world is, as Alan Watts put it, it's the state that the world looks like driving to work Monday morning. and anything other than that is somehow psychiatrically to be disposed of. And so what we want, of course, is the best of having these polyphasic states that include gross, subtle, causal, and non-dual at the sort of minimum in terms of just the broad state capacity, with a structure, a vertical structure capacity that really gets over amber and traditional and gets up to modern and orange and world-centric. And it's that combination that we don't find in any culture anywhere on the planet. So on the countries where we find polyphasic states, we find center of gravity at traditional or amber.
Mm-hmm.
And that is ethnocentric and, you know, absolutely problematic in its own ways. And then in the West, where we do find world-centric, orange, egoic rational, scientific, we find monophasic. And so trying to get both of these together might be sort of another sort of short way to summarize what you and I have been trying to do for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And what the future of religion might look like.
Well, exactly. Exactly, because that's the conveyor belt for religion, helping get them up the structures of consciousness, while also recognizing that there is this horizontal movement through states of consciousness. Mm-hmm.